This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Dave Wilson. Coming up, journalism in Cape Breton. Can it be revitalized? We'll talk with Mary Campbell of the online publication The Cape Breton Spectator. And on The Good Sentence with Paul McDougall, author Silver Donald Cameron on a re-release of The Education of Edward Richardson. That's coming up on Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. Resources are being cut back, and there are fewer working journalists in Cape Breton these days. One publisher-editor of a local online publication is trying to turn the tide. Dialogue spoke with Mary Campbell of the Cape Breton Spectator. Mary Campbell, how would you describe yourself, first of all? Are you the owner, publisher, editor, when you're involved with online newspaper, so to speak? How do you describe yourself? What's your job?
I am all of the above. Plus, I'm also like the main reporter.
So you do everything.
I do everything. Except, I shouldn't say that. That's too quick. I do not do everything because I have some great columnists who write for me and who I am extremely grateful for and really appreciate what they do.
You have roots in journalism, in Cape Breton journalism.
I do.
Big time. If you don't know our listeners, Campbell, the last name. Your father was John Campbell, who worked a long time at the Cape Breton Post as a reporter. Your uncle was Sandy Campbell, who was one of the founders of the Cape Breton Highlander.
Yes.
Is that where your interest in journalism first came from?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. From the time I was a kid, I can remember being a kid. I have two sisters and a brother, and we used to play newspaper. And I got to be the editor because I was the oldest. But no, I was fascinated by it and always interested in current events and always interested in news. And it was always like a topic around the dinner table at home. And I knew what my father did for a living. And my mother was also involved with the Highlander. She wrote a column. And always.
But you didn't start right here. You went off to faraway lands and did your career sort of thing there for a long time before returning to Cape Breton.
Yeah, well, the way I tell it is if the Highlander had still been around when I graduated from high school, I would have gone to work there in a heartbeat. That was the dream. I really did. I always wanted to work there. But it was not. It folded in 76. And so by the time I graduated from journalism school, it's actually kind of interesting. By the time I graduated from journalism school, I was a little sour on journalism and not entirely sure that it was all that it was cut out to be.
Because of the way it was going?
Yeah.
Which is what we're going to talk about eventually, the decline in journalism. But keep going.
I had read this book by Neil Postman called Amusing Ourselves to Death, and he was talking about the nefarious effect of television on society, which seems really funny now in retrospect. But he talked particularly about its effect on journalism and the idea that it was turning everything into entertainment as opposed to information. And it struck such a chord with me that I got really doubtful about the whole enterprise of journalism. Also, it was a really bad economy for journalism when I graduated, which I don't know now if there ever has been a good one. So I ended up doing a lot of different things. Or at least I ended up working for Via Rail in North Sydney for a year after I'd studied French for a year. And then I got a call from Jim McNeil at the Eastern Graphic in Prince Edward Island. It's a weekly newspaper. It had started around the same time as the Highlander did. And I've told this story before, but basically there was a reporter who was leaving, and Jim asked him if he had any idea of someone who might take his place. And the guy had known my sister and me at King's, and he mentioned that both of us were King's graduates. So Jim called the house ready to hire whoever answered the phone. And as it happened, my sister was in Halifax, so I got the job. So I got to work at the Graphic.
That's how things happen.
That's how things happen.
What does he do now, Jim McNeil?
He's since passed on, but he had run basically a chain of newspapers. He had four newspapers.
He was very famous in his day.
Yeah, he's a great guy.
What do you mean when you say journalism? Mm-hmm. How do you describe journalism? Now, you mentioned entertainment versus journalism.
And
Everybody knows these days, you see the e-networks, the entertainment networks. Mm-hmm. People, if a celebrity somewhere does something, that's makes that piece of news or whatever. Mm-hmm. Do you call that journalism?
I guess I call it celebrity journalism. I guess it's a flavor of journalism, but it was never the kind I was interested in, and it's not the kind that I think is really necessary to a functioning democracy. Like, I don't think knowing what Kim Kardashian had for breakfast is going to help me be a better citizen.
Was it, who was it? Was it Winston Churchill who said the greatest foe of tyranny is journalists?
Oh.
I'm paraphrasing.
Yeah.
Is a free press.
That sounds very Churchillian. Isn't it? And it's the Thomas Jefferson quote that if he had a choice between government without the press or the press without government, he'd take the press without government.
So when you say that not the job is not being done, and if you're looking, you did an interview with an online, I can't remember the publication. In that publication, I can't remember the name of it, but in that publication you said, journalism needs to be revived in Cape Breton, but at the same time, you don't think maybe that's possible because resources and the resources that are available and the time, the times have changed, social media and all. Do you still feel that way? This was from a little while ago. Do you still feel that way today?
Well, I guess what I'd say is that I feel like the whole journalism landscape is shifting. Social media, the internet has it's disrupted everything, and it's disrupted journalism, right? It's taken away the financial base that used to support newspapers. The advertising is gone, right? It started with Craigslist taking away the classified ads, and Kijiji is where you would go to advertise something for sale, probably more likely than taking out a classified ad in a print newspaper. So there's this huge shift happening. And my feeling about it is that there are 1,000 different experiments going on right now to see what's going to take the place of the sort of legacy newspaper chains. And mine is one of these experiments. How it's going to turn out remains to be seen. But I think we have to make the attempt, right? Because
the mainstream newspapers and indeed the mainstream media now has been gobbled up by conglomerates, in some cases monopolies, and they own everything. The first thing that they usually do is they downsize.
Oh yeah.
Especially newsrooms. Mm-hmm. Why they do that, I'm not sure, but it's cost cutting and everything else, but that gobbles up journalism at the same time. You described it as nobody does stories anymore that get them in trouble, but you do.
I do.
You do.
I get called a crackpot.
You started out. Your family would have had that name thrown at them a few times too.
Yes.
You started out by doing a story about the Sydney Port revitalization.
Yeah.
Critical of that, and that sort of thing. You got in a lot of feedback from that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But isn't that the opposing viewpoints, the differing opinions, isn't that what journalism is supposed to be about?
Absolutely. What's interesting is that the adjective that's often thrown at me is negative, right? As though being critical is the same as being negative. Critical doesn't necessarily have a negative connotation to it. It just means you're asking questions. That's our job, right?
Which you're trying to get at the truth.
Exactly. I say it's like you're kicking the tires. And if the car falls apart, you don't get mad at the person who kicked the tires. Right.
Yeah. So that's what you do. Let me ask you bluntly, your online publication.
Yeah.
Would you call it successful right now?
Oh, that's a good question. It's successful in that I'm making a living. I'm not making a grand living, but I'm making a living, right? And it's successful in that I've got a very engaged readership, and I've got a good readership. I've got more readers than I have subscribers, which is, the kernel of the problem with the online news is trying to figure out how to get people to pay for it.
Yeah.
And I've been lucky enough to get enough people to pay for it to pay my bills. But I need to get to the next level where I convince some of those other people that, it's worth it. It's worth $5 a month,
To buy.
Yeah.
But it's changed from the days, let's go back to the days when everybody got their news from the paper that was delivered to their door and paid weekly for that paper. And that's where you that's what you relied on as your daily source of news.
Yeah.
And in its day, sold a lot of newspapers.
Yeah.
That's all changed.
It's all changed.
You get it for nothing now, for the most part. If you're talking to a millennial, they get it from their phone. They don't even know what a radio station is or a TV station.
But they know what a podcast is.
They do.
And a podcast is basically radio, right? Which I find really, and I'd love to, I'm going to start trying to interview you.
We have podcasts.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and the thing is, though, I find that really interesting because it's classic. It's radio. It's just people listening to people talking.
It's trying to adapt to the times.
Yeah.
That's what it's trying to do.
Yeah.
And to keep something alive.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, when you're looking at an era, and every journalist, so-called journalist, will weigh in on this. When you're looking at an era that says the trend is to cut and the trend is to get as much as you can for as cheap as you can.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're looking at that, it's a constant battle.
It is, but it's also what, to my mind, it's what's coming to an end, right? What we're kind of talking about is chain ownership, which has dominated the Canadian newspaper landscape for decades.
Well, it's here in Cape Breton now.
Always. It's always. Like, the Post hasn't been an independent, locally owned paper since when? The 1950s?
Back in the 50s, at least.
That's it.
Yeah.
And it's a very Canadian thing, the chain phenomena, right? We have a thing for producing media barons, you know, from Beaverbrook to – it's just our thing. And I don't think it's ever been a particularly positive force in journalism. The argument would be that you've got all this – you've got this big organization and all the forces of this big organization behind you. But you, what you really had was ownership not based in the community and bean counters in charge, which is where you get the cuts to the newsroom and you get everything pared to the bone in the name of the bottom line. And it worked for, you know, a few decades. It made a few people at the top really rich, and it did, you know, provide jobs in journalism. But it's not possible to make a fortune owning a chain of newspapers anymore. Nobody tell Mark Lever. But I don't think it is, right? And so this is what I mean by the fact that the landscape has shifted, and we're just trying to figure out now what it's going to look like.
Well, I think, and let me throw this one by you. I think mainstream news has been infiltrated by what you properly identified as entertainment.
Yeah.
And these e-news stories. At one time, an entertainment story or the story about a celebrity changing socks was no longer news, okay? But now it finds its way into newscasts and so on for whatever purpose. People expect that to be there. They expect to hear that. And they consider it news.
Yeah.
Your readership or your listenership, your viewership, they say, well, shouldn't that be in a newscast? But you're sitting back as a news person saying, no, it really shouldn't be here, but I've been forced to put it in there because of that ownership thing or because my boss said you have to include this in order people want to hear it.
Well, yeah, we expand our audience because we bring in all those people who aren't really interested in news.
Yeah.
they want the entertainment story.
And news always got, again, you've been right almost everything you said so far. News always got that it was always, you know, put in that you're negative.
Yeah.
The news is too negative, and I don't listen to it because you hear about people that die in crashes, and you hear about people doing this wrong and that wrong, and politicians, and I hate them, and I'm not listening to the news anymore.
Yeah.
Because it's just too negative.
Yeah.
And so then they say, well, I'd like to hear some positive news, and that's where it starts.
That's where it starts.
Going downhill.
Yeah.
How do you counter that, though?
So... Oh, that's such a good question. I mean, what you do if you're me is you just put your head down and do news the way you think it should be done and see if people are interested in it. I really have no better answer than that, right? And I'm not alone in that. There's people doing this. It's really interesting in Nova Scotia how many little experiments are going on. So Robert DeVette has got a newspaper, an online paper called the Nova Scotia Advocate.
Mm-hmm.
He's based in Halifax. He's doing incredible work covering issues like poverty and mental illness and dealing. He's got a lot of columnists who are people who are actually in the social assistance system and can write about it from their firsthand experience, which I find to be really informative, right? Maureen Gugu has Guguish, right? Dealing with First Nations issues. Tim Bousquet has got the Halifax Examiner. And he and I offer a joint subscription. Shout out to Tim. He's been, you know, just incredibly supportive since I started this. I know I'm forgetting some. The Independent in Newfoundland, Drew Brown, they're doing some really interesting stuff.
People
like
Parker Dunham, who has The Contrarian.
Yeah, yeah.
It's there, and, you know, I don't know if he charges for that. It's free, but it's online.
It's online,
but
yeah.
It certainly gives you another viewpoint.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. the contrarian one.
Yeah, the contrarian one, to say the least. But, I mean, at the same time, you have a public broadcaster in the CBC, which at one time was looked upon as you will always be there to counter whatever's happening. But CBC has kind of gone over to the dark side as well.
I think the problem with the CBC, want to hear my diagnosis?
Sure, let's go.
It's just that it's underfunded, right? It's like any other government thing. If you have
$1 billion a year is underfunded?
Its funding is not, I'll say two things. I think it's underfunded. I also think that it shouldn't be in television. I think CBC Radio is the gold standard. CBC Radio, I love. CBC TV, I don't watch. I just don't. And I think that this is my draconian answer to it all. Also, full disclosure, my sister is in CBC Radio. But I think if you took the resources that you're putting into producing dramas that nobody watches, or buying the rights to show American game shows, and you put it into radio, you'd be doing something positive.
I think, well, private radio has never been afraid of CBC because they don't sell advertising.
No, exactly.
So they've always been, yes, that's the CBC.
Yeah.
So how much can you do as one person operating an online publication, as much as you can put yourself through?
Yeah, basically. The thing is, I love it.
So that's got to be there.
Oh, yeah. And it's how to explain it. You're a journalist, so you understand. Like, if you love it, you love it. That's one thing. And if you're doing it as your own boss, the boss of me, there's something so freeing in that, right? Yeah. Money is good to a point, but time? Like, when you grant yourself the time to spend 3 days researching a story, nobody's going to give you that in a newsroom today.
You don't have the overhead, though. You don't need office space.
Nope.
You don't need large buildings or anything like that.
I don't.
All you need is that one little laptop.
I need my internet connection, right? Yeah. And because that's sort of the little niche I've decided to carve out for myself is be the person who I call it. I'm stealing this from another online publication, but it's last to breaking news. So I'm not going to be the person you want to, you know, talk to find out what's happening right now in Sydney. But I really like to take the time to go back and read court records and read council minutes and read reports that have already been tabled in the municipality or in the province and try to give context to things that are happening.
Yeah.
That's my niche.
And that's what a journalist does.
Yeah. Yeah. And
that research that needs to be done, that digging up those bones that you want to dig up to finally make a news story.
Exactly. And it's just this. It's hard. It's the hardest job I've ever had, what I'm doing right now. And it's the best. It's just the best.
What do you think? What do you think of Facebook, online, Twitter, all the stuff that's out there now?
Mm-hmm.
The information is you can find out what's happening in a community quicker than you'd ever get from a release that's made by, let's say, the police department or the mayor's office. It's there.
Mm-hmm.
But is there not a problem with? Do you not have to validate?
You have to validate because a lot of the information that's there is wrong.
Yeah.
You must find this. Do you find this?
Well, which is a big part of say, no, we would never use something from Facebook strictly.
No.
But you do. But, in TV and radio, you do get video that's posted on Facebook. How can you argue with that? You're looking at it.
Yeah.
It's as if you were there, if you trust that source.
If you trust the source.
But that validation, again, that becomes, and I've often wondered why, I thought, when social media came about, this will create more jobs for journalists because you need people to write and you need people to validate. Hasn't turned out the way I thought it would turn out.
No, it's but it's evolving, right?
Yeah.
Nothing's turned out yet.
No, it hasn't even begun.
No, exactly.
To me, this is in something like the internet is still in its infancy.
Yeah. You know,
I don't know where it's going to go.
No, we don't. And we're watching, like, I do think we're watching the last days of legacy media, like the bailout for Post Media and all those big organizations. I don't think that's going to solve the problem. I think that, I think that when you've got newspaper chains run by hedge funds, you've got such an inherent structural problem.
Yeah, you do.
That
you do, and I agree with you. That will lead to other problems down the road. But the other thing I see is that I see an entire generation coming up now that depends on that little media device they have in their hand.
But where is the media coming from? That's just the medium, right? I'm getting it through my phone, but if I'm, you know, what am I reading on my phone? You could be reading the Cape Breton Spectator, www.capebretonspectator.com on your phone.
I was wondering when you were going to get to that.
I had to, right? Did I also mention I'm marketing?
No, you can mention whatever you
and
want.
IT, technical support.
Yeah, you have to survive.
Yeah.
In order to do what you're doing.
Yeah.
You need to survive, and that's the same. I mean, radio stations sell advertising. TV stations sell advertising in order to survive. But there's always that happy marriage that can occur between news, journalism, and advertising.
Mm-hmm.
It's always been there.
It requires a
It's always been a
wall.
Struggle. Yeah, it's always been a struggle. There's always been a conflict between the two, but they have coexisted and will have to coexist in the future in order to survive, whether it's online or whatever. So the future for the Spectator.
Yeah.
Where do you see it heading?
So what I really would like to do is get enough subscribers so that I could start. The idea of hiring another reporter would be great, but at least to be able to pay I do pay freelancers now, but there aren't a lot of freelancers. If there's any freelancers out there listening to me.
Looking to get into.
Yeah, print. Because, like, today, for instance, I came to Glace Bay. I don't come to Glace Bay enough. I'm claiming to be writing about the Cape Breton Regional Municipality, this community of communities, and I don't know it well enough.
Yeah.
And you can't cover it. Like, you realize that really quickly. Like, for all the people say, oh, there's nothing going on here anymore, or, you know, it's the population has shrunk and it's aging. No, there's lots going on. And it's the kind of situation where it would be much better to have somebody who knew the territory here.
You still have to get out there, though, right?
You have to.
I can remember being somewhat, not formal training, but on-the-job training as a reporter and told, look, if you go into a different community, and this is when I was off-island, then you want to find out what's happening in that community, hop into a cab.
Yeah.
Go down to the local tavern.
Yeah.
Talk to people.
Yeah.
And they'll tell you what's happening. You won't get it from sitting at a desk over a phone. And nowadays, you won't get it from watching the live stream of an event because there could be more there.
There's always more there.
Yeah, if you're there.
Yeah.
Sort of thing. Or if you, as you said, go through those transcripts, go through those old records, go through those minutes and that and see what's there.
And, like, that is my niche. That's what I like to do. But to figure out what I should be looking at, that's where I need to be. Talking to people and getting out. I have to get out more, basically, is what I'm saying. So, and where I can't do it, it would be really, it's like the goal is to have other people who can do it for me, right?
Yeah. First thing, of course, in this world is you need, you know, you've got to get that website up and everything. Yeah. You've got to let people know that you're out there.
Exactly.
I know you've done that.
You also have to do content regularly, which is something I'm really proud of because I've managed since I launched in August of 2016. You know, except for in the summer, I go biweekly because nobody reads news in the summer, I've discovered.
No, they want to be happy.
Yeah.
See, I bought into it.
Really? You drank the Kool-Aid.
Yeah, I did.
No,
they have other things to do.
They do. And exactly. And so I go biweekly for the summer. So I don't stop completely. I just go every 2 weeks. And over Christmas, I take time off. Other than that, I produce every week.
I know that from having once in the open line show host on Talkback.
Yeah.
It wasn't on in the summertime.
Yeah.
Couple of reasons. One, because people had other things to do, and two, because the kids were out of school.
Yeah.
And they'd tie up the phone lines with prank calls and all that. See, some things when you look behind the scenes are a lot simpler than they seem, okay?
That is something I'm really glad to know. That's funny.
But it's nice to know, it's kind of reassuring to know that there's someone out there working at a job like you do, mm-hmm. putting out a product that says, hey, we're there if you want to read us.
Yeah.
It won't cost you that much, but we do take, we do tell you what's going on, and we do take the way we do it is that we try and tell you the truth by whatever means we can get to telling, well, not whatever means, but by the old-fashioned means of getting
the truth. Yeah, I try to be, like, and okay, and it sounds...
You do, I do, what I'm saying is that you do have, you know, you are credible, right?
I try to be. There are people who say I'm a crackpot, but as you pointed out, I come from a long line of crackpots.
you're misquoting me there.
Sorry.
What I said was that had probably been said to other members of your family.
Yes.
I didn't say you come from a long line of crackpots.
Sorry. Yes. Bad reporting.
Although having known a few of them.
Yes, right? No, I mean, I think my job, like your job as a reporter is to represent the people who don't have time. I often will just watch meetings because they tend to be on Tuesdays and I publish on Wednesday, so it's easier for me to watch it online. And then I can do other things at the same
time. You're talking about council.
Council, yeah.
Well, that would keep you going alone.
Yeah.
I mean,
it would.
Everything that's going through
there
these days.
No, it would, exactly.
Yeah.
But
aren't you, you know, again, I go back to the fact that I see somebody like yourself being there as kind of like a watchdog.
Yeah.
You know, to make sure that, hey, what you say and what you do is going to be reported.
Yeah.
And people are going to be able to, is it not the job of a reporter to say, here's what happened, now you judge.
Oh, totally.
I'm
That's
giving
it.
You the information.
That's it. And I take it a step further and I fully confess to this. I will also tell you what I think. But, and that's a twist, right? That's something that's come out of, it's sort of this part of this experiment in journalism is just putting your biases out there up front instead of pretending to be completely neutral.
At one time,
neutral.
You were never allowed.
Oh, you weren't allowed at all.
No.
No, you weren't.
That was left up to the editorial opinion pieces and all that.
Yeah.
And the commentators who would come on and give their opinion.
Exactly.
Well, I always thought differing opinions made the world go round.
I think so. And I think when you look at the like how newspapers started out, it started out with pamphlets, right? People
yeah.
and everybody was publishing a pamphlet because they wanted to put out their own view. I mean, it can go too far. But my deal with myself is, first of all, I'm going to tell you why I think what I think, and you're free to come to a different conclusion.
Sure.
I'm telling you because you probably should know. I should just be upfront about this instead of pretending that I'm completely neutral because human beings don't tend to be completely neutral. I struggle with it, though. You can tell, right? It's something that people don't actually say it to me much. I say it to myself, like, is this a reasonable approach to journalism? But at this point in my career, it's the only approach. Like,
yeah.
That's what comes out when I sit down to write. So
it's been an interesting conversation. Probably talk to you for a lot longer. Easily.
Yeah, this has been great.
Thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
Don't forget to tell people how do you get online with the Spectator?
So the Spectator is at www.capebretonspectator.com.
It's very reasonably priced.
Very reasonably priced.
Mary, thank you.
Thanks so much, Dave.
Time now for The Good Sentence with Paul McDougall. This week, author Silver Donald Cameron, who has just released his book from 1977, The Education of Edward Richardson.
Sure, well, Edward was a fisherman in Cancel and fished on the draggers in the winter and did inshore fishing in the summertime, and not very different from many, many other fishermen down along the eastern shore and in Cape Breton. But the working conditions they were under were just appalling. They would go out for 2 weeks at a time, working all through the winter in savage seas and powerful winds and so on, and work as long as 62 hours at a single stretch. And when they came back, their pay was sometimes as low as ever. The lowest, I think, was a paycheck of $2.01 for 10 days of offshore dragging. And the reason that the pay was so low was that the fishermen were considered to be co-adventurers with the company. The Supreme Court had ruled that they were not employees. They were co-adventurers, and therefore they were working on shares. But guess who calculated the shares? It was the company, and of course, regarding a fisherman from Cancel as being an equal partner with a multinational corporation from Chicago or from England, is a pretty nonsensical thing. So that's what the strike was basically about, was fishermen wanted to have a union, wanted the law to permit them to have a union, and when it didn't permit them to have a union, they went on strike anyway, set up picket lines and shut down the plants and shut down the offshore fishing so that the their union could be recognized. I should say it didn't have to go back to court. If the companies had wished, they could have said, you know, you're actually right, let's go ahead and we'll recognize your union and let's get down to business and negotiate a contract. That's the way that the United Fishermen, which was the union involved, the United Fishermen and Allied Workers from B.C., that's the way that the union had organized the B.C. fishery. And so there wasn't any real need for this strike, except that the companies did not want a union, and perhaps particularly did not want this one because the leader was communist and they didn't trust him. But that was mostly seen as a smokescreen. The key thing was they didn't want to deal with the fishermen unionizing and didn't want to improve the pay and working conditions for them.
Let's go back for a second. This term co-adventurer, it almost sounds pretty shady, almost like you're going back to the days of pirates or privateers or something.
Where did
that notion even come from? Was this something that came up during this time period, or was this used before, a co-adventurer?
No, that actually has quite deep roots in the fisheries, because of course the old style of doing fishing off this coast was a bunch of people would get together, or one skipper would build a ship, and then he and his crew would go out, and the crew would be largely composed of his friends and neighbors and family. They would all go fishing together, and they would fish on shares. So they really were co-adventurers, taking the fishing voyage as being the adventure. And the share was something like, you know, a double share for the captain, a single share for the ship, and then equal shares all the way around, maybe a little more for the cook or something. But it was a normal way of sharing the risk and sharing the profits. But when that all made sense if you're building a little schooner in Manadu and you're going to go out fishing together. But if you've got a 150-foot steel stern dragger that's owned itself by a company, the whole concept goes out the window.
Yeah, I think when this term co-adventure, this is not unlike kind of the way lobster fishermen or lobster fisher people do their work nowadays, right? You got a boat, mm-hmm. and you got, it might be family or some neighbors on it, and as you said, the captain probably makes more, and then the crew and that's more like a co-adventurer, right?
Well, it is, but even there, I think that's out of date. I mean, my next book is a book called Blood in the Water, and it's about the death of Philip Boudreau, the poacher who was killed by three fishermen down here in Petit de Gras, same community, actually, in the two books, in 2013. But see, the deckhands on the lobster boats these days really are employees. I mean, they get a regular wage. If they catch a lot of lobster or very little lobster or no lobster at all, the deckhand gets paid the same way. So that's not really a co-adventure situation anymore.
Yeah. So who was it that deemed then Everett and his friends and the other people from Petit de Gras and Canso and that co-adventurers? Was this the judge involved, or was this lawyers involved? Who declared them co-adventurers?
Well, there's been an attempt to unionize the fishery on the South Shore in 1947, Lunenburg in that area. that had finally gone to court. And the traditional way of looking at fishing voyages was the co-adventure, which did make some sense in the early days. But in 1947, the Supreme Court of Nova Scotia declared that these guys were still co-adventurers, and that really put an end to unionization for 20 years and more. So at this point, these fishermen were striking against a well-established legal finding that's what they were.
Okay, so it's the strike comes to go because of working conditions, as you've described, the long days out at sea, the long hours at work, and you come back to shore, and before you know it, you're back out again. And so this was all taking a toll on the fishermen and their wives and children and families and everybody. This is what, and the low wages. This is what precipitated it all. Correct?
Yeah. Yeah, and the low wages were really low. I mean, I wrote a piece about it at the time and submitted it to Maclean's, and the editor of Maclean's, Peter Newman at the time, said that the draggermen working in the offshore boats earned between $3,000 and $5,000 a year for 5,000 hours a year, which is triple the usual industrial working time. And Peter said, this can't possibly be true. It's less than the minimum wage. And I said, but there is no minimum wage if you're a co-adventurer, if you're taking shares in the whole thing. But it was these fishing ports were desperately poor at that point. And so that's the kind of thing that drove it. And also, it was really dangerous. Number one, the long hours, the normal hours were 8 hours on and 4 off. So 16 hours a day was a normal working day. And then when you got into a lot of fish and broke watches, there were no hours off at all, which is where the 62-hour strike for Everest comes into this whole thing.
Mm-hmm. You say in the book, when Everett and some of his pals or close friends, they're down in the bait shed or on the wharf or whatever, and they start to reminisce about friends, they identify them by actually the place where they drowned. Like, old Joe drowned over here or there. It's tell us a bit more about this.
Well, it was just routine. I mean, that you expected people to die and to drown and to fall overboard and not be rescued and so on. And that also has been a tradition in the fishery right from the beginning. But I was struck by that they say, we were on that trip with old so-and-so, and now he was drowned in, 63 off an old side dragger out of Alder Point. And, then who am I thinking? Well, you're thinking about so-and-so, and he died, on a dragger out of Halifax. And it was really striking that repeatedly in the conversation they would identify one man by how he was related to somebody else who had drowned. It was just, it was like the signposts, the normal signposts in life in a fishing village.
Yeah, totally matter of fact, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
I can imagine today or even in other occupations in the 70s, this isn't that long ago where you would, dying was just like, literally almost a risk of any day. Not unlike coal mining, I guess. There's the risks in it, and you know what they are, and they're so risky, it just becomes matter of fact, right?
Very like coal mining. I did some research on coal mining some years ago, and the same thing was, if you go and look at the records of coal mining in the 19th century, it's just one disaster after another. They're not big ones, two guys are killed in a rock fall, somebody else is run down by the little carriage coming down the tracks, somebody, the lift fails, and I traveled for a month in 1976 in China with the Men of the Deeps, and I heard a lot from them as we traveled around on buses and planes and so on. I heard a lot from them about that aspect of their lives, and several of them had been really serious accidents. At one point, we were coming up in a cage from the mine shaft in Dangshan, China, and one of our guys wouldn't go down, and I asked him why not, and he said he'd been coming up in the cage one time, and an inexperienced operator had brought it up too fast. It swung from side to side, hooked on a little rock ledge, and the whole side and bottom of the cage tore out, and the men just dropped, hundreds of feet to the road below, and my man had survived because he hung on to the belt of another guy who was hanging onto the side of the cage, and that's how he survived, but he never would go down after that. They found another job for him on the surface.
Yeah.
But that's the thing. It was routine. It just happened all the time.
Yeah. I remember reading in an article a couple of years ago. It was talking about the hazards of working in industries that have to do with energy, and then it was comparing, actually, nuclear plants with nuclear explosions and coal mining. And it said the number of people that have been killed, over the last two centuries in coal mining far exceeds anyone that was ever hurt in, the three explosions in nuclear plants. And the one quote was striking was like in West Virginia there's on average a death a day due to coal mining.
Yeah. And it was similar here, it was just a constant little refrain of the mining business.
Yeah, so let's get back to the strike then. So the union from BC, and it was run by Homer Stevens, and this is the man who you described as he was a self-proclaimed communist. He was a member of the Communist Party of Canada, correct?
He was on and off a member of the party. I think at the moment that the strike took place, he wasn't, because he was having a disagreement with the party over its support for something like the invasion of Czechoslovakia. But basically, that was his political home, was the Communist Party, yeah.
So since you mentioned Czechoslovakia then. So there is somewhat like when you see a big union like this getting involved and a leader who is quite aware of world politics and geopolitics and all that, there is some essence of like what's going on in the world in the world of labor and worker struggles in that, right, at this time period.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. Homer was very aware of the international situation.
And so so one of the two companies, the big company's Booth, right, was actually owned by the English, right? An English company, is that correct?
No, that was Acadia Fisher. Booth was in Petit de Gras, and they were owned by Consolidated Foods of Chicago.
But the other one was?
Acadia was owned by Boston Seafoods Group in the UK. And the manager there, and basically I've structured the story partly as two symbolic figures grappling together on behalf of, on the one hand, the shareholders, and on the other hand, the union members. And so Homer Stevens on the one side, but the manager at Acadia was a guy from Glace Bay, not far from where we are now. His name was Donnie Cadogan, A.L. Cadogan, and in a way, these two guys were very similar. They'd both been very poor. They'd both gotten into the fishery as boys. They'd been around peddling fish door to door. Donnie had come up into the ranks in Acadia. Homer had quickly become he could write minutes, so he got to be an official in the union quite early on. But he'd been a powerful member of the union all the way through. So two guys who had many, many things in common, interestingly enough, but quite different styles and totally different values and totally different loyalties.
Yeah, it's interesting in that how that dynamic kind of developed. And ironic as well, as you said, Cadogan being from Glace Bay and, you know, quite a big fishing community at the time.
And I liked Cadogan, and not many people did, but I did. I thought his story was an interesting one, and I thought he was an interesting guy, and I thought the strike had put him in the worst possible light. But one of the pleasures I've had from the book was that I was very definitely on the side of the fishermen. I mean, I thought they had been badly exploited, and I thought they were heroic in their resistance to it and their continued resistance. The whole thing ran about 15 months.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of it, when I published the book, Donnie Cadogan told a couple of people around him that he'd read the book, and although he didn't agree with everything, he thought I'd been perfectly fair. And to me, that was one of the greatest accolades I ever had for this book.
Yeah, for as a writer of a nonfiction piece of work, what more could you want really than that?
Yeah, that's right.
So another aspect of the strike was that it wasn't just the UFAWU, there was also the Canadian Food and Alloyed Workers Union. So that was backed by the Canadian Labor Conference. So there was something going on between those two unions basically fighting to represent the fishermen. Is this correct?
Yeah, the way it evolved was that essentially the company said, no, you don't have a right to have a union, and the court supported them, and the government supported them, and so on. So finally, after many months on the picket lines, there was the kind of most dramatic moment in the strike was when the companies went to court and got an ex parte injunction to prevent picketing. And that converts picketing from being simply a nuisance into being a form of contempt of court, and the courts can punish it very severely. So at one point, this is why Everett became the central figure in the book, Everett was sentenced to 9 months in jail for walking on the picket line, and that's the point at which the province just kind of exploded. I mean, all the unions walked off the job. People went down to walk on the picket line in the three little ports from the coal mines, from the steel mills, from the construction in Port Hawkesbury, and so on. And so at that point, the companies were, the government was forced to abandon its support of the government, of the companies, rather, and the companies agreed that they would negotiate with the fishermen, but not with that union. And so they wound up getting their first contract with an ad hoc committee of fishermen elected by the rank and file, but not by the union itself. And, of course, as soon as that happened, the Canadian Food and Allied Workers Union saw that there were members here to be had, and there was a real hostility between unions like the UFAWU that were led by communists and the mainstream CLC unions. And so, essentially, you can't quite call it a raid because the UFAWU didn't have a contract and didn't have union recognition. But essentially, the CFAWU came in and said to the companies, look, we're a much more reasonable union than the your point of view. Why don't you recognize us? We'll sign up all the fishermen, and you'll be rid of this whole little difficult situation. And that's essentially what happened.
Did Everett spend the 9 months in jail?
No, that's when that sentence, some of the fishermen had been sentenced to 20, 30 days in jail, and they had sort of shrugged it off. So Chief Justice Cowan was very offended by that, and that's why he laid down that sentence. But then when everybody walked out, the system backed down, and Everett was only in jail for couple of days, kind of thing. It didn't last very long because we were going to have a general strike in Nova Scotia, and the Nova Scotia Federation of Labor was threatening that. And so they said to take the steam out of this whole thing as quickly as possible. So they ended the proceedings against the fishermen, and then later quietly dropped the charge.
When they did start to threaten to put people in jail and all that, the fishermen for walking the picket line, that's when the wives and sisters and mothers and everybody got involved with the picket line as well, correct?
That's right, because the injunction named certain fishermen, said Edison Lumsden, Everett Richardson, Floyd Richardson, and so on across, Cletus Sampson, and so on across the board. They were named and said, you are commanded not to walk on the picket line any longer. And at that point, the women and the children said, if they can't do it, we can. They weren't named, and so they went down on the picket line. Of course, they were joined there by all these people that walked off the job in other places as well.
So, the picket line, these picket lines, were they in front of the fish plants or down on the wharf and in front of the boats? Where do they set the picket lines up at?
Basically, they picketed the company's plants. And of course, the wharves were associated, attached to the plants. And by closing the gate to the plant, you've closed access to the boats and everything else.
Okay. So, where are we today now in as far as unions and the fishery? What's the state of it today? Because you don't hear a lot about it.
No, because there isn't much of a fishery, compared to what there was in those days. That we have fished out the cod.
Right.
So that same sort of situation doesn't apply. Unionization did spread throughout the fishery, but I'll tell you where there's a parallel situation still, and that's over the question of the injunction, the anti-picketing injunction. Those are normally ex parte injunctions, which means the court only hears one side of the argument. So if I'm running a company, for example, I go to the court and I say, my business is being ruined, it's an emergency, we've got to stop picketing and get back into production and that sort of thing. And they don't call the union at that point. And the judge, it's often done very informally. I've heard of one judge issuing an injunction while shaving in his own bathroom. but it's very one-sided. But what it does is it converts what's just really a nuisance, so a minor crime, trespass or something like that, into a defiance of the court. And, of course, the courts take their own dignity very, very, very seriously. Well, that form of ex parte injunction has been used against student activists, it's been used against all kinds of people, and the one that would be most familiar right now, it's exactly the same process that Everett faced, is the Keystone Pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
And the picketing out there, once again, Trans Mountain went and got an injunction to ban picketing, and people who then picketed went to jail, and one of them was Elizabeth May, the leader of the Green Party, and one of them was Kennedy Stewart, who was then a New Democratic MP and is now the mayor of Vancouver. But there is an injunction in place. If you go out to Burnaby and try and trespass on the territory of Trans Mountain Pipelines, you'll go to jail. And the sentences are getting longer and longer and longer as that goes on.
So I take it this is part of the relevance of the book today. When you did it, it was the education of Everett Richardson. I'm calling it. It's almost the re-education, right? It's still out there, right? Some of these issues, and I take it this is part of why you wanted to reprint the book to get it back out there in people's hands.
Yeah, number one, I wanted to be sure. I wrote the book so that the strike would not be forgotten. And in fact, not only has the strike been forgotten, but a large part of the labor history, certainly in this province, has been forgotten. I mean, the labor battles that went on at the steel mill and the coal mines and elsewhere in the province, not much record of those is in the public consciousness. So I wanted to get that back, and I also wanted to draw a parallel with the environmental movement, because in those days it was the companies were being confronted mainly by the labor, by labor. Today they're being confronted by environmentalists, as witnessed the Keystone situation. And it seemed to me that we've now got to a point where we should be finding an alliance between labor and the environmental movement, because they're basically fighting the same enemy, but the battle has widened. So, the misdeeds of large corporations that disregard the public interest affects now all of us, not just the labor.
You've written a new introduction for the book, correct?
Yes.
And that sort of sets the stage for what events and things that are going on today, correct?
Yeah. If you've got 7 million people in the streets, about environment, about climate, it's important to know that these things can succeed, and they start with a small number of people. I mean, Everett Richardson's strike was 235 fishermen in 3 little ports on the Nova Scotia coast, and it practically brought the province's economy to a halt. So I think the same, that this is something that people who are now in the streets protesting on environmental matters need to remember, that, yeah, you can win. This is not impossible. David and Goliath stuff, but Goliath is the guy who wins in the end.
Mm-hmm. And you can see it. Well, it's happening right now, December in France, right, with the strikes against the government for all the various workers, right? I mean, they've got millions of people in the street there, right?
And they have had some success too. They have rolled back some of the. I'm not entirely sure that their objectives are ones that I would share. But in terms of the power of organization and getting into the streets and getting into the face of authority and throwing sand in the gears of production, but there they are.
Silver, I want to just thank you for doing this, and all the best with the book. And I'm just going to leave off with this one sentence that I think kind of sums up the whole thing from the book. I don't know much about a co-adventurer, the fisherman declares, but I don't see how they can keep us from getting organized. And to me, I think that sums it all up. Okay?
That's really the nub of it.
Okay.
One thing, if I can add one thing, I would say that I want to mention that the Cape Breton Curiosity Shop on Charlotte Street in Sydney has copies of the book, and you can buy them online from Amazon, or you can buy them from my own website, silverdonaldcameron.ca, but I think the only place in Sydney that they're readily available is the Curiosity Shop, so I thought I should mention that.
Silver Donald Cameron, thank you.
Thank you, Paul. This has been a pleasure.
And that's our show for today. As always, thanks for listening. For Dialogue, I'm Dave Wilson.
Catch Dialogue 3 times weekly, Sundays at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m. Dialogue is a production of the Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-849-9303 or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue, check out our Dialogue podcast, available now online at coastalradio.ca.